This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Players with the Laboratory Theater of Florida are currently performing the satirical comedy An Act of God by acclaimed comedy writer David Javerbaum. Javerbaum is a former head writer and executive producer of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. The play is an adaptation of his 2011 book, The Last Testament, a memoir by God. In the book, he blurs the lines between comedian and theologian by taking on the voice of God, just as he does with the Twitter handle at The Tweet of God, which has more than 3 million followers. He will once again put on the voice of God as he joins our discussion about the nature of God, religion, and other existential questions tackled in the play, and what should prove to be a rather unorthodox discussion. But first, the world-class musicians of the nonprofit chamber music group Sarasota Music Aviva are in the midst of their third full season performing at venues in and around the Sarasota region. The group is known for introducing audiences to new and rarely performed pieces, as well as fresh arrangements of traditional chamber works. The group has an ambitious schedule of performances coming up in the coming months. Joining me now for a closer look is the organization's co-founder and artistic director, flutist Linda Bento-Ray. She's also principal flutist with the Venice Symphony Orchestra, and she's on the board of directors for La Musica International Music Festival in Sarasota. Linda earned her bachelor's in music at the Boston Conservatory of Music and her Master of Music degree from the New England Conservatory. Before coming to Southwest Florida, Linda Bento-Ray made a name for herself performing with some of New England's most prestigious symphony orchestras as both a section member and a soloist. Linda Bento-Ray, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hi, thank you for having me, John.
And I invite listeners to join the conversation as well. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And first of all, Linda, given your prominent role in the professional classical music scene in New England, what made you want to relocate to the Sarasota area in the first place back in 2014?
Well, it was really my husband's idea, and being a musician, I can take my skills and my performances anywhere. So we've always loved the west coast of Florida, so it was a natural attraction for us, and we knew that Sarasota was a cultural hub, so it was an easy decision. Plus, Ann Hodson Pilot, a harpist whom I've performed with many times from Boston, lives in Osprey, so that was also another big draw. And the area is beautiful. I mean, what can I say that's bad about the Sarasota area? So it was a natural progression for us.
And as you mentioned, you and your husband came down here. You founded Sarasota Music Aviva together. What made you decide to take on this project and to do it here? I mean, what I'm thinking is you've got this vast array of quality offerings of arts in the region, but did you just kind of say to yourself, this is great, but there's something missing, we can fill that gap?
Well, we actually transferred our nonprofit to Florida from Massachusetts. So even though we've only had Sarasota Music Aviva up and running 3 years here, it really was in existence in Massachusetts under the name of the Worcester Symphony Chamber Players for about 10 years before that. So we were kind of seasoned pros at fundraising and holding all sorts of interesting events to generate new audience members. So it was more a transferring of the organization than a startup, though it is a different climate here. But indeed, we did see that there is a lack of my niche, which is bringing to audience members unusual pieces and pieces that are underperformed, underserved. And so it was an easy spot to fill.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that as well. I mean, is there a particular benefit that you find in introducing, you know, perhaps seasoned classical music audiences to, you know, composers and works that they maybe have never heard before, as opposed to, you know, the traditional standards they all know and love?
Well, I think it's actually kind of serendipitous, to be honest. For instance, I fell in love with Joseph Yongen's work because a friend of mine dragged me to a concert. So Concerto Sank, which is a piece that I recorded on my first CD, was performed at that concert, and that was it. I had fallen in love with Joseph Yongen, and I put that piece on my bucket list. And about 10 years ago, when my mother was sick with Alzheimer's and I was her legal guardian, I needed a project because I was really distraught at how sick she was. And so I went to my bucket list and thought that was the perfect piece to perform and called Ann Pilot, and she had performed it years before and said, great piece. So we built a program around it. And interestingly, all of these great musicians from the Boston Symphony wanted to be a part of it because nobody had ever heard of this guy. Mm. And that's how the whole love affair with Joseph Young and began, and that's how the CD project grew from. So it seems that every new piece that I introduce has a story attached to it, which is kind of interesting. And it's not really that I'm looking at textbooks saying, oh, this piece is missing from standard repertoire. It's more like which piece falls in my lap next.
Okay. I do want to get back to Young in just a little bit in the show. But first, I wanted to go ahead and hear some music. And the first selection we're going to hear is titled Whirlwind Waltz. It's from Spring Serenade for Flute and Piano by Peter Schechel. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And that's from your album entitled Invocation. Before we hear a sampling of that, is there anything you'd want to say to introduce the piece?
Sure. Well, Peter Schechel is PDQ.
Thank you. Schechel.
And yeah, and Vitas Baksis, my pianist from Boston, and partner in crime and all of these CD recordings and many concerts, introduced me to that piece. I had never heard of Spring Serenade, and it's actually a very legitimate piece of classical repertoire that he was commissioned to write, Peter Schechel was commissioned to write, and it's really brilliantly written and absolutely underperformed, so it fit right into my paradigm, and Whirlwind Waltz is a great representation of Schechel's cheeky humor. I mean, he's just the master at the pun and you know, musical comedy, and I hope your listeners enjoy it.
All right, well, let's hear from that. And that was just a taste of Whirlwind Waltz from Spring Serenade for Flute and Piano by Peter Schechel. And that is from the album Invocation of our guest, Linda Bento-Ray. Yeah, that was really interesting. It's a bit of not exactly your standard waltz. There's a lot of playfulness in there.
Oh, yeah. He definitely injects silly into his writing. Yeah.
And, you know, I wanted to get back because you had mentioned Joseph Young, and you have actually come out with an entire album of his works. And, you talked a little bit about the fascination there and how that first came about. From what I understand, really the only works of his that are performed regularly anymore are compositions for the organ.
Yes, that's true. He was an organist. His dates were 1873 to 1953, and most of the music that I've performed and recorded was written in the 1930. He was an organist and an educator, and he was very critical of his own work. He wrote tons of chamber music for all instruments. He particularly loved the viola, so there's a lot written for viola, but there's also a lot written for flute and for winds. And it's been told that just before he passed away, he destroyed maybe 30% of what he had written because he just didn't like the music enough, and he was afraid that that would be his legacy. And it was, you know, he just wasn't proud of that 30% of the music, which is really a shame. But it was easy finding his music. It's interesting because when we recorded this CD, you have to buy mechanical licenses in order to distribute the music. So we had to pay the people who owned the actual scores, and that is the Belgian government. And most owners charge $200 to $500 for a mechanical license, and the Belgian government charged us $1,500 a piece. So they have tried intentionally to keep this music close to their country, which is really a shame because it's extraordinary music, and Jongen deserves to stand right aside of Debussy and Ravel and all of the great composers. So I was very proud to bring this music, especially the Flute Sonata, into the light, because we need more and fresh repertoire, and there's a lot of it that already exists that we just don't know about.
Well, let's go ahead and hear now a piece from that sonata for flute and piano that I believe you were just referencing. And this is, again, on your album, entirely of Joseph Jongen compositions. And this is the movement Tres Animes, if I'm saying that correctly.
That is correct.
Okay, good. Let's go ahead and hear that now. Was a bit of a Tres Animes from the Sonata for Flute and Piano from composer Joseph Jongen. Again, a recording performed by our guest today, flutist Linda Bento-Ray. And that was Vitas on that recording with you, with the piano?
Yes, that was.
I really love in there the sort of the call and response that we heard between the flute and the piano. I thought it was interesting because you mentioned that a lot of what he liked to feature was the viola, but he has all these flute pieces as well. And I just thought that was interesting because I don't always put those instruments together. You know, there's a little bit of a different register there.
Well, we are completely polar opposite, I
yeah.
think. But he liked the sound of the viola. I think he featured the viola in more pieces that he wrote than he actually featured the flute. There's only one flute sonata. I can't speak intelligently about how much repertoire he actually wrote for viola, but I think it's more substantial than what features the flute.
Do you think there's any chance that any of those, you know, because I read that the number of opuses he wrote eventually reached something like 240. Do you know how many of those remain or why he destroyed so many of them before he died?
Well, yeah, I don't really know the exact reason why. I mean, he could have been ill at the end. Who knows? But I think it's, you know, around 30%, so maybe you do the math. But
yeah.
I think it's very sad that that happened. And he's just an amazing composer. One thing I can say about his writing is that When you hear a group of four instruments performing his work, it really sounds like there's an entire symphony orchestra playing, because his orchestration is just so thick and so rich and so masterful. He's just an amazing contributor to our repertoire, and you need to know about him. People need to know about him.
Yeah. Well, sort of tangentially related to what you were just saying, you know, regarding the, you know, contrasting a full symphony versus a chamber group or a string quartet, what do you see as the difference from the point of view of, as a player, between playing with a full symphony and playing with a chamber group? It's, you know, you don't have the conductor. You really, there's a lot more reliance on each other, the eye contact, the you know, really moving together, being in sync.
Well, they're both extraordinary experiences, first of all. I think chamber music for me is, you know, everybody says it's such an intimate experience to perform and to listen to be a part of, but I think it's more engaging, and certainly in my chamber music concerts, I don't like it to be a lot of distance between the audience and the musicians, so I steer away from venues that have stages, and I don't like there to be a wall between the musicians and the audience, so I try to engage the audience, so we never have written program notes. We have verbal program notes. And even though there is a ceremony, an unwritten ceremony around, we'll call it, quote-unquote, classical music concerts, that we want to honor as classical musicians, it can also be stuffy and standoffish and make people feel that they're not privileged to it, which is wrong. It's everybody's birthright. So having said all of that, the actual music making, there's such a reliance on nonverbal cues in chamber music,
yes,
reading each other's body language, reading each other's energy, so to speak, that's just otherworldly. You can't really describe it, and it puts you almost in a trance state when you're involved in it, and you just create incredible moments that also are created in symphonic performances. But I think because there's so much more in play in a symphony than in chamber music in terms of communication amongst each other, that it, to me, it's almost a spiritual event. I'm sorry to say that, but it truly is very profound. That's why I'm so attracted to it.
Yeah, I had the privilege myself of being able to attend a performing arts magnet school and loved playing with my string quartet. But man, when we were performing, I know what you mean. Like my, you know, the bow arm of my first violinist was like my whole world while we were performing. And tell me more about your concerts as well. We've talked about how, you know, there's less of that barrier between the musicians and the audience. It's more intimate. Do you ever talk to the audiences about the works that they're hearing as well as just performing at these events?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we stopped providing program notes many years ago, mostly because what I found was people were interested in reading them while you were performing. So they might have read them briefly before the performance, and then while we're performing, something might have triggered a memory, and then they'll sift through paperwork to try and find what they had read, and that becomes a distraction for us and for them. So what we do is we speak our program notes, and we talk about why the music is important to us, what it means to play it, and what effect it might have on the listener. And people ask questions, and they become engaged, and then it becomes their performance instead of our performance, which is important to me because that's why we do this. We do it to make it be a profound experience for the person sitting there. You know, I have a profound experience every day when I'm practicing scales. I know that sounds really corny and weird, but it's the truth, and that's why I do it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, someone who isn't privy to chamber music might only have that experience once in their life or once a month, and so I want them to walk away kind of feeling like they were transformed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd love for our audiences to get another taste of what the Youngin Project album has to offer. So let's go ahead and hear another piece, and this is the Tre Desidia from Concert a Sunk, I believe.
Yep. Concerto Sunk. Concerto for Five.
And that was a bit of a Tre Decida from Concert de Cinq, also by composer Joseph Jungen. And that, again, is off the Jungen Project album. We have Linda Bento-Rey, flutist for that album and artistic founding director for Sarasota Music Aviva. You had mentioned before a particular harpist that you had really enjoyed playing with from the Boston area. Is that who we just heard on that recording?
Yes, that was Ann Hobson-Pilot. She was the principal harpist with the Boston Symphony for many, many years. She's now retired, and she lives in the Sarasota area and still performs. Great harpist.
Yes. And in reference to her and to, other musicians here in the Southwest Florida area, I can't imagine it was too difficult for you to locate musicians of the caliber you really needed to be part of these performances, given what a cultural arts mecca Sarasota has kind of developed into, and given the fact that this was an organization that existed before you moved it down to our area.
Well, it's always easy to find great musicians. Many, many great musicians around. And interestingly, many musicians love to perform chamber music. So I'm very blessed that we have the folks playing with us who we do. They're great people.
And we're now firmly into the holiday season. And earlier this year, you released an album of fresh takes on traditional holiday songs. What was the motivation for that? Tell us a bit about the album.
Well, Noel reinvented holiday classics. Was really my husband's idea. He is not a musician. And I am very fortunate to have Russell Gant, who's the music director at WSMR in the Tampa, Sarasota area, perform. He plays lots of my pieces on the radio. And last holiday season, my husband said, you should really do a Christmas album, because I bet Russell Gant would play a lot of that on the radio. And so on July 3rd, we recorded 7 Christmas tunes that were reinvented by composer, arranger, jazz musician Bob Nesky in the Boston area. And we spent a day in the recording studio, and this is the result. And it was fun. It was fresh. It was just a great experience. And they're quirky. If this album doesn't make you giggle, nothing will make you giggle. This is about the most fun music, I think.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and hear a selection from that album. We're going to hear Masters in the Hall. And without further ado. Was a bit of a fresh take on Master in the Hall. It's on the latest album from Linda Bento-Rey called Noel. It's a lot of reimagined fresh takes on traditional holiday tunes. I really liked that one just because, especially because it had the triangle and the djembe in there. And Sarasota Music Aviva is now in the midst of its 3rd full season now. Can you tell us a bit about some of the upcoming performances you're looking forward to in the coming months?
Sure. Well, we have Vitas Bakshis coming for an entire week in early January, and he and I will perform 5 concerts that week. One of them is actually at my house. It's a fundraiser, and we still have some seats available. So if anybody's interested in coming, they can contact me, maybe through my website. But he will present a program that evening called Anti Musica. He is an aficionado of tongue-in-cheek, kind of musical comedy, very, very, very intelligently written pieces that are puns on classical music, kind of the Victor Borge of the present day. And his programs are just amazing. And so he's going to perform a bit of that, and then we'll perform a few of the holiday classics on that concert. So we have a whole week of Vitas, and that will culminate with a concert on Sunday the 7th at the First Congregational Church of Christ in Sarasota. And that, even though it says on my brochure that it's Woodworks, that's been moved to the spring. But this concert in particular is called Narrowly Classical, and it will have lots of chamber music, big ensembles, and pieces that kind of fall outside the traditional definition of classical. For instance, a piece by Takamitsu called Rain Spell for vibraphone, harp, piano, clarinet, and flute. That will be kind of the flavor of that concert. Followed immediately by a children's concert, Peter and the Wolf, on January 14th, and then a tribute to the West Point Band in March, another concert at St. Andrew's Episcopal Church on Boca Grande featuring strings and me, another concert in April, same ensemble, strings and me. So we have quite a bit coming up. We tend to play about 10 concerts a season, so we're halfway through.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your music with us. That is, unfortunately, all the time we have for this portion of the program. But thanks so much to my guest, Linda Bento-Ray. She's a flutist, co-founder, and artistic director of the nonprofit chamber music organization Sarasota Music Aviva. Thanks so much for being with us, Linda. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And as we close out the segment, we'll hear another selection from Bento-Ray's latest album of holiday classics, O Come, O Come, Emmanuel. We're taking a short break, but when we return, the Laboratory Theater of Florida in Fort Myers is currently running productions of the satirical comedic play An Act of God by acclaimed writer David Javerbaum. The play is based on his 2011 book, The Last Testament, a memoir by God, which blurs the lines between comedian and theologian by taking on the voice of God, just as he does with the Twitter handle at The Tweet of God, which has now grown to more than 3 million followers. Javerbaum will once again channel the voice of God as he joins our discussion about the nature of God, religion, and other existential questions tackled in the play. That's just after the break. Stay with us.